From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Cambodians continuing to flee Thailand. Fraud allegations threaten historic Afghan political transition. New approaches needed to rein in abuse in North Korea. These stories and more on this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Aid organizations in Thailand say tens of thousands of Cambodian migrant workers and their children continue to arrive at a border checkpoint in Thailand. They are unconvinced by the Thai military government's assurances they are not being targeted in a crackdown intended to rid the country of illegal migrants. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has more from Bangkok.
The International Organization for Migration and representatives of concerned non-governmental groups tell VOA News thousands of Cambodians are still converging on the Phoi Phei border checkpoint. The numbers are not as large as seen during the past weekend, but still enormous, according to those monitoring the situation at the Thai-Cambodian border. It is estimated that at least 200,000 Cambodians this month have fled home from Thailand. 10 concerned organizations, including a Catholic Legal Aid Society, the Migrant Working Group Network in Thailand, and the international NGO Save the Children, have sent an appeal to the country's military junta to stop suppressing migrant workers. Roysai Wangsuban is an officer with the Migrant Working Group.
Now Thai society, especially entrepreneurs, are suffering by the short-sight policy that focus on national security and arrest and deportation. The immediate thing we want the army to stop crackdown, arrest and suppression of migrant workers.
Roysai, speaking from Chiang Mai, says unknown parties are taking advantage of the situation there and in Mae Sot, which is on the Thai border with Burma, also known as Myanmar.
We received a report of a person who dressed like a law enforcement, and they came to the community and make extortion situation that they might come to the community to arrest the people. And some people paid the money, and also it creates fear in the community.
That has prompted some employers using undocumented workers to scale back business activities, including factory production. While a substantial percentage, perhaps the majority, of Cambodians in Thailand have left the country, activists say those with citizenship of Myanmar have mostly gone into hiding rather than cross the border. There are an estimated 2 million workers from Burma in Thailand, an essential and cheap workforce for the construction industry and several other industries. Advocates for the migrants met Tuesday with officers of the Royal Thai Army's 4th Regional Command at Mae Sot. Roysai says the soldiers agreed not to target illegal workers there until there is further clarification from the junta leadership, but she remains concerned.
We are talking about nationwide situation. There are many law enforcement besides the army, so I think there is no guarantee that army will respond to our recommendation.
The junta on Tuesday issued two related decrees. One states there is no policy as yet to crack down on migrant workers despite widespread reports to the contrary. It did acknowledge requiring employers to submit for review lists of all their workers. The second announcement states that any government officer found to be involved in human trafficking, in particular concerning migrant workers, shall be punished through both disciplinary and criminal proceedings. Thailand's treatment of foreign laborers is under much scrutiny. The country this week faces being placed on the U.S. State Department blacklist of nations failing to adequately address trafficking of persons. The Global Slavery Index considers Thailand a hub of exploitation, with victims of slavery originating both from within and outside Thailand's borders. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The century of humiliation is well known to Chinese students. The rest of us will learn more about it later on Daybreak Asia. The UN Special Investigator on the Human Rights Situation in North Korea says imaginative new approaches are needed to turn around the country's appalling record of violations against its people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, where the investigator has just submitted his report.
UN investigator Marzuki Darusman says it is time to move away from the old method of submitting reports and passing resolutions of condemnation against North Korea at the UN Human Rights Council. He says it is time for the international community to reconsider its exclusive focus on the tragedy and heinous violations taking place in that country.
You can go down the list. Prison camps, death squads, and the whole range of violations. But it has proven that a continuing battering on the basis of findings and of updated information gets us nowhere closer to a resolution of this matter in terms of accountability, but also in terms of engagement of the country.
Darusman says North Korea must be made accountable for its crimes. He says the Security Council is the only body that can refer perpetrators to the International Criminal Court. He says countries that have influence on North Korea, such as China, should be persuaded to put greater pressure on the government to end its violations. But mainly, the UN investigator is pinning his hopes on the establishment of a field office in South Korea. He says this field office, which is likely to open in the next couple of months, would act as a permanent watchdog of developments in North Korea. He says the office staff would interview high-level escapees and look into the structures of the country. He tells VOA the office will carry out investigations, monitor, and document evidence of abuse.
It would also be involved in outreach to the international community to continue to keep the international community aware of the situation in the north, and not reduce this issue to a half hour or an hour debate every March on a resolution.
Darusman says the field office will work closely with a so-called contact group composed of representatives of 10 countries. He says the group will be a bridge between the Council's two yearly sessions to keep North Korea's atrocious human rights record on the international front burner, with the aim of making the government accountable for its actions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Afghanistan's front-runner presidential hopeful says the ballot counting process should stop, alleging widespread vote fraud. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad the political turmoil threatens to derail a transfer of power from one democratically elected government to the next.
Millions of Afghans turned out June 14th to participate in the country's first presidential runoff election, defying violent attempts by Taliban insurgents to disrupt the voting. The runoff pitted the winner of the first round, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah, against the number two vote-getter, former Finance Minister Ashraf Ghani. But speaking at a hurriedly called news conference Wednesday in Kabul, Abdullah announced he is boycotting the vote-counting process because the Independent Election Commission has failed to address his complaints. He accused top officials of the commission of helping what he described as blatant and mass fraud.
We do emphasize on the legitimacy of the process, and that is for the legitimacy of the process that we suspend our engagement with the commission. We have asked our monitors to leave the counting centers of the commission in Kabul as well as in the provinces, and we are asking for the counting process to be stopped immediately.
Abdullah cautioned that if the commission continues counting ballots, it will have no legitimacy. He says he has been repeatedly demanding the Election Commission remove one of its top officials for directly interfering in the vote. The presidential hopeful alleged the turnout figure announced by the commission was inflated, suggesting it was meant to help his rival. Abdullah said an option to resume the counting process could be the formation of a UN-supervised committee in which members of the rival presidential candidates are represented. A spokesman for the Election Commission says it will look into Abdullah's complaints, but the counting process will not be halted. In a message on Twitter, Ghani has said his campaign condemns every vote of fraud, and if anyone has evidence of fraud, they must refer it to the National Electoral Complaint Commission. The former finance minister added his observers will continue to do their job and remain engaged with the Election Commission as the local and international observers doing. Lawmaker Fawzia Kofi, a leading women's rights activist in Afghanistan, tells VOA that the political crisis is a worrying development for war-shattered Afghans.
If this election is not very clear in terms of the fraud allegations and looking at the fraud allegations and the demands of different candidates in terms of bringing more transparency in the process, it could certainly undermine the trust over institutions.
The winner of the election will replace President Hamid Karzai, who has led the nation since the US-led military intervention ousted the Taliban in 2001, but constitutional term limits prevented him from seeking another term. The Election Commission, according to the official timetable, will announce preliminary results on July 2nd, while the final results are due July 22nd. All US-led foreign combat troops plan to withdraw from Afghanistan by the end of this year, and a trouble-free political transition is considered crucial for orderly winding down of the military mission. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Our program page has much more. If you're online, stop by voanews.com/daybreakasia. Chinese and Vietnamese officials meeting in Hanoi Wednesday have failed to resolve the most recent flare-up in a long-standing maritime conflict in the South China Sea. Both sides maintain their positions in the first high-level talks since the May deployment of a Chinese state-run oil rig that led to a standoff at sea and deadly anti-China protests in Vietnam. China's foreign ministry quotes state counselor and top diplomat Yang Jiechi as telling Vietnam to stop disturbing Chinese operations in the area and hyping up disputes over an island chain he called China's inherent territory. Vietnamese Prime Minister Nguyen Tan Dung, who met with Yang Wednesday, is quoted by the official Vietnam news agency as saying China is violating international law. China, meanwhile, is the number one buyer of Iraqi oil. Last year, the China National Petroleum Corporation, or CNPC, produced 299 million barrels from Iraq, almost one-third of its overseas output. The sectarian battle that is now tearing through Iraq moved to that country's largest oil field on Tuesday. The Beji refinery provides fuel for domestic consumption in Iraq, and reports say any lengthy outage there risks long lines at the gas pump and electricity shortages. But if other oil fields are attacked, what would that mean for China? Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Holly Morrow, a fellow of the Geopolitics of Energy at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, about the situation as it affects China.
China currently buys about half of Iraq's oil output, so they're important to each other. China is very important to Iraq as a consumer of its oil, and Iraq is important to China as fourth or fifth largest supplier of oil. So it's a big deal. But the thing that always needs to be kept in mind when talking about particularly oil flows around the world is that oil is a fungible commodity. So even if all of Iraq's production went offline, say, China could buy the oil that it needs from other places. It's not restricted to, you know, certain allotments of oil from countries A, B, and C. Now, the way that the Iraq crisis would likely translate into an impact on China's interests is, I think, two ways. One is the impact on price, and we've already seen that the Iraq crisis is having an impact on the price of oil globally, which, as the largest importer of oil, affects China, along with the U.S. and others, but principally China. And then also the impact on any Chinese workers in Iraq. And I have heard that China, CNPC in this case, is evacuating workers out of Iraq. But all of that is to say China is important as both a producer through CNPC of Iraq's oil and as a consumer of Iraq's oil, but it is not it's not going to threaten fundamentally China's security of supply if some of this oil goes offline. And the thing that should be kept in mind is that most of Iraq's oil production, and particularly the projects that Chinese companies are involved in, are in the Shiite South, so much less vulnerable to ISIS-controlled and some of the other Sunni-dominated parts of Iraq.
Well, even taking that into consideration, do you think there is any talk in China among the Chinese or among the Chinese and other countries about China possibly becoming a political player in Iraq?
I don't think so. And I think the reason why is because China is generally not looking to involve itself in complicated disputes far away from home, especially in a situation like Iraq, where the U.S. role and influence is as large as it is in Iraq. I think in Iraq, unlike in some other places like Sudan, China can essentially free ride, if you will, on the U.S. role. So the U.S., I think, is likely to have to become involved in some way to defuse this crisis, roll back ISIS, if they can. And China will be the beneficiary of any intervention from the U.S., so it doesn't have to put its own blood and treasure at risk.
You said that China could just find other suppliers of oil. Where do they go?
Global markets. The way global oil markets function is that any buyer can basically buy a barrel of oil at any given time at the prevailing global price because there's no supply shortage right now. So when crises happen in Iraq or Libya or any of the big oil suppliers, it never means that people cannot buy the oil they need. It just usually means that the price of oil goes higher.
Holly Morrow, a fellow of the Geopolitics of Energy at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. She was speaking with Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman. School children in China learn from their earliest classes that their country was a victim. A victim of wars and natural calamities for a long period of time. Known as the Century of Humiliation, the list of adverse events is taught not only for historic value, but to build nationalistic pride as the Chinese overcame extreme hardship and turmoil. Zheng Wang is Director for Peace and Conflict Studies at the Seton Hall University and also a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. He tells in his new book, Never Forget National Humiliation, how this teaching, combined with a glaring omission from 25 years ago, has aided the government in Beijing.
When people talk about China, very often people focus only on the economic statistics, military statistics. What I'm trying to do in this book is trying to, because I think is more important and is more challenging for people, is to understand China's intention, because their intention determines their strength. And I believe to understand the people's, this group of people's, their understanding of history, their historic memory is very important for people outside to understand this group of people's, their motivation, their intention, and their objectives. One of the key elements I think not sufficiently discussed is about the period of history. In China, people call it the Century of Humiliation, from the First Opium War in 1840 through the end of the China-Japan War in 1945.
That perception of the history really legitimizes a lot of the actions that the government is taking now. One in particular, the claims in the South China Sea as historically part of China.
Yeah, it's actually a very good example. The whole world is currently talking about how the Chinese government taking aggressive actions in the South China Sea, and they criticize China's territory claims. But if you talk to people inside China, you will find that many people criticize the government being soft, not doing enough to protecting China's rights and interests. The power of nationalism and also the power of the historic memory, because many Chinese people, they receive the education and they strongly believe this is belong to China. And it's not something, you know, it's just in recent years, because this is based on the historic claims.
We in the West tend to talk so much about China's rise, whereas in China, it's not so much a rise as it is a return.
Yeah, exactly. Chinese, they prefer to use another term. If we translate into English, it should be rejuvenation or rejuvenating. they are emphasizing China is not rising up from nothing. China is return to its old glory, or its return to its central position in the world.
How is this so-called century of humiliation taught to Chinese students in today's classes?
You will find actually it's very interesting, the different period of time that the students, they are being taught the different interpretation or different contents about their country's national experience. Recently, I gave some lectures in Chinese universities, and I was, to my big surprise, I found many of today's students, they probably know very little about what happened 25 years ago, the students' movement, but they know very well about what happened 100 years ago. So that is actually, I think it's because the education they received, so their memory becomes selective.
The events in Tiananmen Square 25 years ago obviously were something that the Beijing government did not wish to acknowledge. And was the increased emphasis on history before Tiananmen the way that the government was able to recapture a national identity?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The reason history is important is it plays an important role in constructing a nation's identity and perceptions. So at that time, the government, they were facing a major crisis of legitimacy and a major crisis of people no longer believing in socialism, communism, and the party. So they want to use this education, especially the humiliation education, to trying to making, especially the younger generation, reshape people's identity and perception, and trying to use this to strengthen the party's legitimacy.
You mentioned in your book natural disasters as part of the national humiliation. So many of the world's largest natural disasters had actually happened in China.
China is one of the few countries in the world that suffered a lot of major earthquake or major natural disasters because the geography situation, very frequent flooding and earthquake. So indeed, in my book, I discussed about that. If we use the 2008 earthquake as an example, you can say that this kind of nationalism also played some positive role for this group of people to fighting and to conduct some reconstruction.
We have so many Chinese students studying here in the United States, and as they possibly do get the other sides of the story and take that home, that could present a dilemma.
You're exactly right. Because I'm a university professor, I know that in recent years, there is a rapid, unthinkable rapid increase of the Chinese students coming to the U.S. and to the other countries in the world. Now they have the access of the information they couldn't access in the past. But what I'm trying to do in this book is that I'm trying to argue that Chinese nationalism or Chinese understanding of history is very complicated. Oversimplification has been a major reason for many misunderstandings between China and Japan, China and the United States.
Chen Wang, Director for Peace and Conflict Studies at Seton Hall University, a Global Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, and author of Never Forget National Humiliation, Historical Memory in Chinese Politics and Foreign Relations. The book is published by Columbia University Press. We never forget to bring you the latest world news. Steve Norman is next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
That's one.